let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. The Israeli regime is pressing ahead with its aggression against Lebanon, leaving more civilians dead and injured in its latest round of attacks against the Arab country. At least four people were killed and several others wounded in Israeli bombings, targeting areas in the southern city of Tyre. Israeli warplanes also targeted a house in Al-Bazouriyya, southern Lebanon, killing several people. Nabatiyeh and the western Bikaa region were among areas targeted by the regime's military. At least 31 people were killed in Israel's Monday strikes. The Israeli army also destroyed several bridges in Syria near the border with Lebanon. The attacks come as far-right Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has declared his objection to a possible ceasefire agreement with Lebanon, calling on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to continue the war until achieving absolute victory. The war in Lebanon has so far claimed the lives of nearly 3,800 people and injured 16,000 others since October last year. The United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, has warned that the intentional targeting of cultural heritage during armed conflicts in Lebanon and Gaza may constitute war crimes under international law. The warning followed a joint report by UNESCO and the UN Satellite Center in Geneva on the damage to cultural heritage sites in Israeli bombings of Lebanon and Gaza. UNESCO officials said that Lebanon has 34 World Heritage Sites, including in Baalbek and Tyre, which have recently been the subject of Israeli attacks, putting them at risk. Krista Pekat underlined that these sites are under UNESCO protection and any attacks would deem a war crime. She added, dozens of monuments as well as historical and archaeological sites have been affected in Israeli attacks on Lebanon. The official also highlighted the 1954 Hague Convention, which prohibits targeting cultural heritage sites in any armed conflict. The Lebanese resistance movement has carried out fresh retaliatory operations against Israel, targeting the regime's positions with missiles and rockets in the occupied Palestinian territories. According to Israeli media, some 10 missiles were fired overnight Monday, with some of them hitting the city of Nahariya and its surroundings, plunging the area into darkness. The attacks led to a fire and inflicted damage to vehicles and buildings. Two settlers were also reportedly injured, one of them critically. Earlier, Hezbollah targeted the Foram camp for the first time with a barrage of rockets. That's a base for the deployment of Israeli ground forces in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. The group also hit a number of settlements, including Miron and Avivim, with a salvo of rockets. Hezbollah has, time and again, said that its operations are in defense of the people of Lebanon and in solidarity with Palestinians, as the Israeli regime presses ahead with its bloody mayhem against the two nations. More Palestinian civilians have been slaughtered in Gaza as the Israeli military continues to pound the blockaded territory with more attacks. The northern Gaza city was a target of several Israeli strikes. In one of the deadliest attacks, at least six civilians were killed and several others wounded after Israeli warplanes targeted a house in the El Tufah neighborhood. Several Palestinians were killed in Israeli bombings of a house in the vicinity of Sheikh Radwan Lake, and three civilians were also killed following Israeli airstrikes on a gathering of Palestinians in the city's beach camp. The Israeli aggression on Gaza began in October last year. Since then, more than 44,200 people have been killed and nearly 104,700 others injured. Well, now joining us live from Deir al-Balah is our correspondent Muti Abu Musabih. Muti, please, as we have seen just in the latest developments, more Palestinians have been martyred in these air raids on their houses in the El Tufah neighborhood, the Sheikh Radwan Lake, and others. The massacres are continuing now, and we know the humanitarian situation. What details do you have us from there on the ground?
Yes, that's true. Actually, the Palestinian people are still trapped between the ongoing and the constant Israeli bombardments and attacks carried out left, right, and center in all areas of Gaza Strip and the catastrophic humanitarian conditions that are still befalling the Palestinian people as a result of the perishing winter conditions. Over the last night, the Palestinian people actually were struck in different parts of Gaza City, particularly whereas at least four Israeli strikes struck and pounded several residential buildings. The first one was in At-Tufah area, particularly in Al-Zarqa area in At-Tufah neighborhood, killing at least six Palestinian civilians as they were struck inside their house. In the meantime, another airstrike actually was carried out against the Palestinian people in Al-Sabra neighborhood, while we have another airstrike that targeted another house in Tal el-Hawa neighborhood. And previously, we have four Palestinian civilians were killed in Al-Sheikh Radwan neighborhood after the Israeli warplanes bounded and destroyed their residential building. And as you know, we have at least three Palestinian civilians were reportedly and confirmed killed after they were targeted in a Shara refugee camp after the Israeli fighter drones attacked a gathering of the Palestinian people. The current situation is still excruciating for the Palestinian people in Gaza City, particularly over the last night. As you know, the Israeli occupation forces also maintained their brutal artillery shelling targeting Al-Sabra, Tal el-Hawa, and the Zaytun neighborhoods respectively, while the northern part of the city also witnessed more cruel attacks by the Israeli artillery, including Al-Saftawa area. When it comes to the northern part of Gaza Strip, as you know, the Israeli military campaign is still underway and abated and brutally targeting every corner of the northern section of Gaza Strip. And those attacks were intensified over the last night against Beit Lahia City, which witnessed more cruel airstrikes by the Israeli occupation forces. At least two residential buildings were targeted and destroyed by the Israeli warplanes in Beit Lahia City, killing two Palestinian civilians. And as you know, the Israeli attacks against the vicinity and the yards of Kamal Adwan Hospital actually are still ongoing till this moment as we speak right now. Needless to mention that the Israeli artillery continued to shell and target multiple areas of the northern section of Gaza Strip. The Palestinian people are still afflicted by this ongoing military campaign, which is still ongoing for its 51 consecutive day. So we are talking about catastrophic humanitarian situation for the Palestinian people in all areas of Gaza Strip. As you know, the Palestinian people are still taking shelter and living in these worn out and the flimsy makeshift tents, which are ineffective or inefficient to protect the Palestinian people from the perishing winter. And as you know, they are still suffering because, as you know, we are witnessing heavy rains, particularly over the last couple of days, and thousands of the Palestinian makeshift tents were completely flooded by the water, particularly for those Palestinians who are living by sea. Even the sea waves actually engulfed and flooded the makeshift tents. So we are talking about another chapter added to the ongoing suffering of the Palestinian people. And the situation is extremely horrific for those Palestinian people, and it is worsening every moment, particularly as I've mentioned, as we still having the winter conditions here in Gaza Strip. So unless having any urgent intervention in order to stop this ongoing war against the Palestinian people, we are talking about unprecedented conditions for the Palestinian people. And as I mentioned, those who are lucky to survive the ongoing brutal Israeli strikes may be unlucky to survive the perishing conditions of the winter here in Gaza Strip.
I'd like to thank you very much, our correspondent Muti Abu Musabah there from Deir al-Balah Live. Thank you for those reports and stay safe. Iran's foreign minister has criticized the UN inaction on Israel's acts of aggression, saying the international community should not allow the regime's lawlessness to be normalized.
The atrocities in Gaza and Lebanon reveal a shocking reality, a war strategy that dismisses humanity, morality, and universally recognized principles in favor of unlawful aggression. The suffering in Palestine is the tragic result of 8 decades of occupation and persistent denial of Palestinian rights, particularly their inalienable right to self-determination. The Security Council entrusted
Abbas Araghchi emphasized the need for a global coalition to end the Israeli genocide in Gaza and its aggression against Lebanon. He stressed that safeguarding the UN Charter requires effective collective action to end these crimes. Araghchi made the remarks in the extraordinary meeting of foreign ministers of the group of Friends of the UN Charter to discuss the humanitarian situation in occupied Palestine. Iran's top diplomat also called for accountability and punishment of Israeli leaders and their military supporters, especially the United States. He described the International Criminal Court's arrest warrants against Israeli leaders as a necessary but overdue step in the pursuit of justice. Iran's Deputy Minister for Legal and International Affairs has called for preventing the efforts to politicize the works of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, urging global actions against Israel's use of banned weapons in Gaza and Lebanon. Qasem Gharibabadi issued the call while addressing the 29th session of the Conference of the States Parties to the Chemical Weapons Convention in The Hague. The Iranian diplomat highlighted the country's stance on chemical weapons, the crimes and violations of Israel, and the West's support for the regime's crimes against the people in the region. Gharibabadi slammed the Israelis' use of chemical weapons and other dangerous substances against Palestine and Lebanon, calling on the OPCW chief to take measures to protect the victims. He then referred to the West's support for former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran, saying that Germany and the United States were the main suppliers of chemical weapons to the Saddam regime. A large-scale campaign under the slogan Warmth for Gaza has been launched in Jordan to offer in-kind and financial donations to Gazans as winter approaches. Organized by the Islamic Action Front Party, the initiative has garnered widespread public support, as Zaid Akarba reports.
The Warmth for Gaza campaign, launched in Jordan with widespread public support, aims to provide essential aid to help Gazans endure the harsh winter. The suffering persists for the hundreds of thousands of displaced and affected people in Gaza.
The nature of donations for Warmth for Gaza campaign focuses on in-kind donations, including blankets, food parcels, and tents. Since the launch of the blessed Al-Aqsa flood, the Jordanian community has consistently demonstrated a strong willingness to participate in every campaign introduced. This particular effort was organized to prepare for the winter season in displacement camps and has been warmly received by the public. However, we always aim for greater engagement, especially as the situation in Gaza becomes increasingly dire. Donations are collected at the General Secretariat branch of the Islamic Action Front Party. The party receives these donations and sends them through the Hashemite Charity Commission. The commission ensures that these donations reach those in need within the Gaza Strip.
As winter sets in, concerns are mounting over the escalating famine crisis in Gaza, fueled by severe food shortages and the lack of basic essentials. This campaign, the largest of its kind in Jordan, aims to provide urgent aid, including blankets, winter clothing, and heaters, to help ensure a dignified life for Gaza's residents during this challenging time.
Since the events of October 7th, Jordanians have tirelessly worked to deliver aid to our brothers and sisters in Gaza through every possible means and at every opportunity. However, the need becomes even more pressing during the winter season. Winter, even for those in the comfort of their homes, is a season of cold, hardship, and concern. Now imagine enduring it in a tent. Today, many of our people in Gaza are struggling with the cold. They have been displaced multiple times, migrating from one area to another, and now face severe shortages of blankets, tents, and children's coats. Through the Warmth for Gaza campaign, we aim to provide as much support as possible to bring warmth to children, the elderly, and the entire community.
The Islamic Action Front Party in Jordan, organizer of the campaign, had earlier launched the Join Us in the Electronic Storm initiative. With the hashtag Warmth for Gaza, Jordanians from across the country participated via social media, which played a crucial role in raising awareness of the campaign. Jordanians continue to stand with Gaza's resilience through all means. A widespread donation campaign seeks to provide vital aid as Gazans endure harsh winter conditions amid the deepening crisis.
زيد عقاربي عمان.
Violence is escalating in Pakistan's Kurram, a region bordering Afghanistan. The National Unity Council has met in Karachi to address the crisis and the failure of authorities to maintain law and order. Muhammad Turi reports from the port city.
The National Unity Council meeting focused on the urgent need for government action to curb the violence in Kurram Agency, particularly after the Bagan convoy attack. Leaders from various schools of thought stressed unity and urged the federal government to ensure security and justice in troubled region. They also announced plans for continued actions if no substantial measures are taken.
At a time when the global attention is on Gaza and Lebanon, the Pakistani federal and provincial governments have failed to control the worsening situation in Parachinar and Kurram Agency. Leaders here demand immediate action to prevent further chaos.
Adding to this momentum, the Parachinari diaspora worldwide has announced demonstrations to pressure the Pakistani government. Starting in Melbourne, protesters will march from Federation Square to the Victorian Parliament House to draw international attention to the crisis. More protests are expected to follow in other cities globally before Pakistani missions.
This meeting is a call for unity and immediate government intervention. The situation in Parachinar is not just a regional issue. It's a national and international concern that requires urgent attention.
Can you imagine that not a single security official in front and rear of this convoy was hurt? How much do we spend on these security agencies from our national budget? We want a high-level judicial inquiry into this matter. People were murdered in their custody.
Leaders condemned the state's failure to protect the convoy and demanded accountability for the security lapse. While the attackers remain at large, the community continued to mourn the lives lost in this tragedy.
We demand a judicial commission probe this matter. The government must make a committee to inquire how this heinous crime occurred in the presence of security forces.
While the attack continues on Shia Muslims in Kurram Agency, the National Unity Council vowed in Karachi to keep raising its voice through press conferences, protests, and diplomatic efforts until the government takes meaningful steps to restore stability in Kurram Agency. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
Well, please stay tuned to World News for more updates on these stories and more. Until then, goodbye.
Ever since you left, I must confess, the world has become a total mess. You were the bridge that connected hearts, always there for us when we were in distress. Everywhere I look, I see your trace. You tried to make the world a better place. Oppressors will never forget your frown. The oppressed will not forget the smile on your face. Oh, how you shine like a constellation in the sky. Oh, how you shine in the minds of nations that hold you high. Oh, tell me how it feels under the tree of bliss. The trees you planted are missing you, but they've learned to blossom just like you. Though you were marred
slaughtered mercilessly. An army of you is growing globally. 'Cause people are tired of all this prejudice. They wanna fight like you against injustice. Your name is Qasem Soleimani. You're a hero of humanity.
You defy the limits of intelligence, sending shivers down the spine of global arrogance. You decried oppression in every form, even though it put you in the eye of the storm. You extinguish the flames of terror far and wide. You help countries to reclaim their land that was occupied. That's why people will remember you as a hero. Though the powers that be will picture you as a foe. You see, they instigate the terror and manipulate the news so they can whitewash every crime to make the world confused. They can say what they want, let them curse at the mirror. Truth will always prevail, let them live in error.
You found the key to heaven's gate. Martyred for justice, what a noble fate. Your legacy will linger on. Forever your name we celebrate. Oh, how you shine like a constellation in the sky. Oh, how you shine in the minds of nations that hold you high. Oh, tell me how it feels under the tree of bliss. Oh, how you shine like a constellation in the sky. Oh, how you shine in the minds of nations that hold you high. Oh, tell me how it feels under the tree of bliss. Oh, how you
Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we will be speaking to an acclaimed academic and author who has been at the forefront of numerous high-profile human rights fights for justice. Now an adopted son of Belfast, he's never found wanting when his wisdom or expertise is called for local or grassroots communities. But before we do, let's get a quick overview on this week's topic.
On the 15th of April 1989, a severe crush in two central pens at Hillsborough Stadium, Sheffield, led to the deaths of 97 Liverpool fans. It occurred as the FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest kicked off. Shortly before kick-off, the inexperienced match commander, Chief Superintendent David Duckinfield, with a clear view above the terrace from the police control box, ordered exit gate C to be opened to ease crowding at malfunctioning turnstiles. Fans, unstewarded, entered through gate C and down an unlawful 1-in-6 gradient tunnel headed standing. Yet the pens were already severely overcrowded. Fans were trapped by high fences to the sides and to the front. So severe was the crush, a barrier collapsed and bodies piled up. In addition to the eventual 97 deaths, 766 fans were injured and thousands traumatised. The deadliest tragedy in British sporting history. In the immediate aftermath, South Yorkshire senior police officers and the Police Federation fed false stories to the media, claiming violent Liverpool fans, many without tickets and drunk, had caused the disaster. These allegations persisted throughout a hostile media despite Lord Justice Taylor's 1990 interim report finding the main cause was the police failure to control the crowd. Yet, there were no prosecutions of police officers or public bodies, and initial inquests returned an accidental death verdict. This led to a 3-decades-long campaign by bereaved families and survivors. Addressing the 20th anniversary memorial at Anfield in front of a crowd of 30,000, the Culture Secretary, Andy Burnham, committed the Labour government to full documentary disclosure by all organisations involved. In 2010, the Hillsborough Independent Panel was appointed by the UK government to oversee and analyse the disclosed documents and publish a detailed report. On the 12th September 2012, it published its report. It launched a website containing extensive material collated from 85 organisations and individuals over 2 years. The panel concluded that the behaviour of fans in no way contributed to the disaster. The main cause was lack of police control. Crowd safety had been compromised at every level, despite previous near-death incidents on the terrace. The panel concluded that up to 41 of those who died might have survived had the response of the police and emergency services been appropriate. Before a packed House of Commons, Prime Minister David Cameron apologised on behalf of the government, Ed Miliband on behalf of the opposition. Other authorities, including the South Yorkshire Police, followed suit. Former editor of The Sun, Kelvin McKenzie, initially apologised for making false accusations under the headline The Truth. Subsequently, this was moderated. New inquests were initiated lasting 2 years. The jury concluded all who died had been unlawfully killed, and the fans were exonerated of any blame.
And with that, I would like to introduce my next guest. Professor Phil Scraton has been a leading light for those challenging corrupt institutional power structures. Widely known for his work on the Hillsborough Independent Panel, a team that was instituted to oversee the disclosure of documents about the disaster that led to the deaths of 97 Liverpool fans in 1989, he has been at the centre of many other successful institutional findings since. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean.
So, Phil, tell me first of all a bit about yourself growing up.
Well, I was born on the other side of the river from Liverpool in Wallasey. My mother was from Birkenhead, a Birkenhead Catholic, an Irish background. My father was a Liverpool-born Protestant. And so I was the product of a mixed marriage, and so understood right from the outset the issues that, the tensions that exist around religion. Particularly the tensions between Irish Catholicism and English Protestantism. And my father converted, actually, but never went to church. And I grew up in not a very wealthy family, but somehow one of the only handful of people from my school. I got the 11 plus, went to a grammar school, which I hated from the moment I walked in. It was a former public school, and it had all those traditions. And the young ones got beaten by the old ones and all of that. It was a dreadful introduction to the world of immediate power relations on that level. And it worked at two levels. One, I felt that subjugation because I was a Catholic in a Protestant grammar school. But I also felt the subjugation of poverty. I came from a home where my mother and father had to scrimp just to get me to the school, to buy the uniform, for example, and all the gear that goes with that. So I felt lost. And within 2 years, I'd left. And believe it or believe it not, these days, I went into a seminary. I'd been an altar boy since I'd been very young in the local Catholic church. And, yeah, the priest would come round every Friday night and they'd talk and chat. And they got me to play for the local church team and all of that. So my first love was football and Liverpool FC, which I know won't go down that well with you, Sean. But that was my first love. And second was, I suppose, I was devoted to the church. I mean, I was, 8, 9, 10, 11 when I was on the altar. So it seemed obvious to me that maybe going off and trying to emulate the priests that I had so admired at that time. That was why I went into the seminary. There was also at that time another formative moment, which never left me, and which I should have realised even at that age, was the real contradiction. There was a wee fella in my church, in my school, who was really poor. We weren't well off, but he was really poor. And he used to steal from the local shop, but he didn't steal sweets, and he didn't steal lemonade. He stole food, and that food he would steal to take to his family. And this was the first time I ever experienced anything like this. Later in life, I went through this again. And he got caught. And I'll never forget the day all the girls were taken out of assembly and all the women teachers left the assembly. And we sat cross-legged on the floor. And we didn't know what was happening. So there was a bang at the back of the hall, and we were sat there rigid. And these two teachers walked up. They looked massive from where we were. And wee Frank was walking between them. And they got him up to the stage. And the head teacher was on the stage, the deputy head, and the local parish priest. And the head teacher looked at all of us and said, "This week, Frank Ruddy was found stealing. And he is on this stage because of that. He let himself down. He let this school down. He let his family down. But most of all, he let God down." And they took him, they bent him over a desk, and they caned him 6 times across his backside. And they marched him down from the stage, and as he walked past, the tears were streaming down his face. Otherwise, he was emotionless. I sat there terrified. In fact, I was holding on to myself. I thought I was going to wet myself. And I learned a lesson that day, that moment, which didn't really click for a while afterwards. It was about the use and abuse of power, physical abuse of power. And that stayed with me. Even after that, when I went to the seminary, that stayed with me. And I saw that sort of behaviour again in the seminary. And I lived for 4 years in under that fear, in that kind of situation. And also in the seminary, I was very well aware that some of my friends were being abused. And I left the seminary in 1966. In fact, I will never forget the moment I left the seminary. It was like a massive pressure lifted from me. It also coincided with the World Cup, and I went to Goodison Park three times to see the Brazil match, the Portugal match, and the North Korea match. And that was my first and last experience of Everton's football ground, because I was never missed across the park at Anfield.
Well, we both have many discussions on the rivalry between Everton and Liverpool, but we'll save that for another day.
Yeah.
So tell me, Phil, how did you come to work and live in Belfast? Because you're now an adopted son.
After I got into academic work, and that was a strange experience in itself, because when I was finishing university, my first degree, which was sociology at Liverpool University, the thing that was said to me straight away was, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Oh, I'd like to be a researcher." And basically, the career guidance guy who was in the School of Sociology smiled and laughed and said, "No, I don't think you'd be cut out for research. I think you should go and be a social worker or a teacher or whatever." And nothing against social work or teaching, but I really wanted to do research. And so I enrolled for a master's by research, and I did it on the Irish-born Liverpool travelling community. And I witnessed there some of the worst racism I have ever seen. I come from a city where racism, particularly institutionalised by the police, on the Liverpool-born black community is really serious. But this was of a different order, seeing people dragged from their trailers in the middle of the night, their families. And I suddenly thought, am I a researcher or am I a witness to what is state abuse? So I wrote all that up, and that kind of steered me then into work in academic life, where the research was always going to be geared to abuse of power. And that work went on all the way through from that period, all the way through my work on institutionalised racism on Merseyside, my work on deaths in custody, my work on a whole range of controversial topics, which included eventually disasters and tragedies. And it was against that background that my, for want of a better word, career developed. I worked at the Open University full-time, then I worked at Edge Hill University, Liverpool University, and then I came to Belfast. I remember after the interview, I was travelling back to Aldergrove, and I was in the taxi, and the guy said, "What have you been here for?" And I said, "I've been over for an interview." And he said, "What on earth do you want to come to this place for?" That was his response to, "You live in Liverpool, why do you want to come here?" And I thought to myself, this is a crazy question. Because in my head, and I'd been coming here, I'd been a failure a lot, I'd done a lot of different things here, different talks, and I knew quite a few people in Belfast. And to me, I saw it as a privilege that I'd been offered a job in Belfast. Because when else in your life would you have the opportunity to live and work in a place that is going through transition from conflict? This is on my doorstep. People in England had had not even the slightest notion of what was really happening in the north. And from my point of view, to come here and to work in this environment during a period of transition, and this was a period when, as you will remember only too well, 20 years ago, when there was a lot of tension, particularly in the paramilitaries, amongst the loyalist paramilitaries, there was a lot of tension. And it was getting a lot of headlines in England. But to me, it wasn't about that. To me, it was about being part of the society which was really going to face major transitions. Because I think when people talk about the transition from war to peace, what they fail to think about is, at a distance, it looks like the war is over, peace prevails, everything changes. Well, it doesn't. We all know that is a complete myth. Anybody who's lived here knows that that is a complete myth. Because in that situation, intergenerational trauma becomes such a powerful force. People who've been in prison for long periods of time, people, hardly a family that hasn't, in working class communities, hardly a family that hasn't lost somebody or hasn't witnessed some of the worst examples of power being directed against them individually, whether by paramilitaries on the one hand, but most significantly by the state, the armed forces. I never forgot the moment when somebody said to me, one of the very first times I came here, "When I went to school," she said, "every day I came out of my house, I had to step over a rifle, because we lived in a corner house. And the squaddy would be down with his rifle across the front of the step, and I had to step over that." That image stayed in my mind of a child. You know, I mean, yes, we all know the major atrocities. We all know the major conflict. We all know the situation of shootings, of bombings, and all the rest of it. We know that. But that one image of a young child stepping over that barrel every day and it being normalised as part of her life really stayed with me. So arriving in Belfast and witnessing and listening to people's stories, there was some of that was part of my own history, but not to the depth, not to the real pain of everyday life that had become normalised. And that to me was so significant. And the realisation, working as I did with families, by that time families of the bereaved, families of prisoners, in a broader sense, that to me really had an impact. Because what it was saying to me was, you know, this is an issue that's not going to go away in the medium period. So when people talk about transition from conflict, they have to understand that transition takes three generations minimum. I see that with my daughter-in-law, who was born in the former East, in Berlin. I see it from her family's experiences, that you don't unlive the lived lives of your grandparents, of your parents, simply because you're born at a moment of peace. And you inherit that background, you inherit that suffering. The things that are said and left unsaid in families are all part of that history. So for me, I work around the issue of about three generations, when we can start to put real meaningfulness on, yes, the society has transitioned. And it's not just about who's in power and what their histories are. That's part of it. But it's actually about personal experience.
I completely agree, Phil. And there's something that struck me. Me and you had a conversation one time about Manson. I know we have all these cliches and all these buzzwords around the peace process, etc. But I'd said to you, we've been talking about something at Manson, you know, a post-conflict society. And you stopped me and you says, we're not in a post-conflict society, we're still in conflict. Yeah. And like it made me think, and you're absolutely right, to think that we're able to talk about a post-conflict society when there's so much trauma in our society still, when the injustices are still there, when the state is redacting documents, when they're burying the truth, when they're changing laws so families can't get to the truth, killing civil cases, inquests. We're not even in the end of the period where there is a post-conflict society. I think the British government is fighting a war on a new front against victims and survivors. So it did strike me when you said that, you know.
The inequality of arms that exists during a period of conflict, let's be clear about this. The inequality of arms is about a state intervening in a conflicted society. The state is not neutral. The state is never neutral. The state always supports a status quo which it considers is in its own best interests. And I'm talking here about not just about individual politicians, because there have been some good individual politicians, but I'm talking about the British state as an entity. And it has to protect its history. It has to protect its own direct involvement, not only in the deployment of the military in the north, but also it has to protect its reputation in terms of being seen to be value neutral, which it never was. It's not only in the north, which is the north of Ireland, which is in itself a major, major issue. In terms of state involvement. But you see it at every level in the work I do, where the state interests, whether they're the police, the prisons, whatever, the state interests are always protected. So getting to the truth in the north is something that is not in the state's interest. To have the whole truth and nothing but the truth will never happen. I'm convinced it will never happen. In the work I do, not just on the North, but in the work I do, I see redacted documents. I see what it means for those in authority to go through documents and strike out passages. I've seen what it's like. I'm talking here, for example, around Hillsborough. I mean, these are 97 people who die at a football match, right? This is not about a civil war. This is about people dying at a football match. And I've seen how a panel of carefully selected police officers under the direction of the chief constable go through the statements of all of their police officers and review them and alter them. Now, review and alteration are not my words. They're their words. That's what they set up. So if you project that from 97 people dying at a football match into a situation where you have a war, where you have a relationship between the military and the police, why would we be surprised to discover that documents go missing, documents don't exist that should have existed, that when those documents are found, that they are redacted, that they are changed? Why would we be surprised if it can happen in the event of protecting reputations around policing football in a peaceful society, a harmonious society? Why would we be surprised that during a time when the state itself is conducting a war, when there is military on the streets, when the helicopters are flying in hour after hour, why would we be surprised to find that the truth is redacted in statements? Or it's never written, or it's hidden. Doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Phil, I want to thank you again for coming over to this side of the city to see me. You're always welcome, and it's always great to have you here in the West. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Sean. Thank you.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd once again like to thank our special guest, Phil Scraton. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran while shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kHz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English programme, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be asking a question which is very important. A lot of people ask it. And this question is related to a more general topic of maintaining one's relation with one's kin, which is, as you know, is an obligation in Islam. And conversely, severing one's ties to one's kin is also a sin. It's one of the major sins. So in this connection, we want to ask the following question. What is the least one can do to maintain relations with one's kin. Any, what is the least that one can do to avoid this sin? Because as you know, a lot of times, you know, some people have relatives who are unbearable, intolerable, you know. And aside from that, maintaining relations with them, if we go and meet them and converse with them and sit with them and visit them, a lot of times those people are irreligious. By meeting them and you know, associating with them, we could be become afflicted with other sins, you know. They could be, you know, accustomed and to backbiting. They could be accustomed to consumption of intoxicants. You know, they could be people who have, you know, nothing to do with religion. So in this situation, you know, if we associate with them too much, we could become afflicted with other major sins. If we don't associate with them and completely sever ourselves from them, this would be a case of severing one's relations from one's kin. So what should we do? Well, this is the question we want to address today. Fortunately, we have some hadith which we can take inspiration from to answer this question. In one blessed hadith, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam has been narrated as having said this: maintain relations with your kin, silu arhamakum, even if it be with a mere greeting, assalam, walau bisalam. Even if we just, you know, we call this person up and say hello to them and ask their well-being, this would be sufficient, and we would not have, you know, disobeyed God with respect to that ordinance. In a similar tradition, it's been narrated that Imam As-Sadiq, the sixth Imam, alayhi salam, he said the following: maintain relations with your kin, even if it be by offering them a drink of water. Sil walau bisharbatim min ma. Right? That's sufficient. It's not necessary if you're, you know, if one of your relatives comes and he says, hey, I need to, you know, I want to borrow some money from you and you cannot do it, right? That's not considered severing relations from your kin. But yeah, if he comes to your house and you don't offer him something to drink, right, that could be a case of severing your relations from him. In continuation, the Imam said, the best way to maintain relations is to refrain from hurting them in any way. It's a very beautiful explanation. We shouldn't hurt them. We shouldn't annoy them. We shouldn't bother them. You know, even if we suffice ourselves with this much, we would have be considered as somebody who has fulfilled this obligation. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the least one can do to maintain relations with one's kin in the light of the hadith of the Prophet and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
lullaby, my darling. Lullaby, my son, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. I've dug the earth with my hands, my bare hands. I've searched for my roots in this soil, this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, now I offer my son to you. See, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms. I put him on your chest, still in my roots, Palestine, 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 Palestine. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my child, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since somebody inside my aching heart, somebody inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots me here, this land.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Fresh missile strikes on Israel's military bases and forces as a movement presses ahead with retaliatory operations against the regime. Israel massacres more Palestinians in Gaza as part of its genocidal campaign in a blockaded territory that has so far claimed the lives of more than 44,000 Palestinians. And Iran urges the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons to take action against Israel for using banned weapons against the people.